Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Oh, my wonderful, wonderful guests and my wonderful, wonderful audience. Again, we're the best, you know. You're the folks on the cutting edge. You're the folks who are going to make a difference in the next 100 years. You're the folks who actually try to understand the experience of people who go to see psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and physicians. You actually try to put yourself in the place of people getting lobotomized and electroshocked and drugged. You are the courageous, honorable ones in the field. It is such a pleasure to do this radio show with you. I've recently updated my website, Breggin.com, and I found out today that for several months now, since updating, we're getting 1,000 visitors a day. It's a lot more than we used to get. Let's make it thousands. Let people know about this resource, Breggin.com. And I've told you about my tardive dyskinesia section on my website. Tardive dyskinesia is that awful disease of abnormal movements that's caused by the antipsychotic drugs at incredibly high rates, like 5 to 8% a year, cumulative in healthy people, 20 and 30% a year in older people, bizarrely high rates. Of this disorder, and it's also can be caused by other drugs that affect the area of the brain called the basal ganglia and dopamine nerves. SSRI antidepressants can cause variations on tardive dyskinesia. So I've got a website about that and neuroleptic malignant syndrome, and I've expanded it now so that it's now called the Antipsychotic Drug and Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center. It's got, I don't know, 150 or 60 PDFs you can download. It's got at least 15 sections, each with a paragraph followed by all the relevant articles on rates of tardive dyskinesia in each age group with the articles, neuroleptic malignant syndrome with the articles, standards of care for lawyers and other people who are interested in that with all the articles. It just goes on and on, atrophy of the brain with all the articles and so on. And I'm going to continue to be expanding this for the rest of my life to provide a place for people to go where without me, they can take over for me and they can do things on their own, benefiting from the thousands of hours I've worked on these kinds of issues, hundreds of thousands probably. And all the time put into this particular resource. I have the equivalent resource that's separate from the website called the Electroshock Resource Center. So they're all out there for you. And please let our folks know what's going on here. And while you're letting them know what's going on, let them know about my guest, Peter Goertze, G-O-E-R-T-Z. No. Peter, misspelling your name. I think I got it right. And Peter is the amazing author of two very recent books, Deadly Medicines and Organized Crime, and now Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. Peter is a Danish physician. He's a researcher. He created a research center that is famous around the world for monitoring medical reports and studying them. Maybe he'll tell you a little more about that today. You can find him on the website, on the web, G-O-E-R-T-Z-E. Peter is a great man. That's it. Simple enough. He's a medical doctor whose research was focused on medical issues, who then started to look at psychiatric issues and brought an honest eye to those issues. And he's now up there like a brother out there writing enormously powerful books, speaking around the world. I'm going to have him, I think, for the third time to the U.S. in September. We'll be telling you more about that. It's going to come to Columbus, Ohio, and do a day there, or do a couple hours there, and I'm going to do a couple hours at a health conference. My respect for Peter is just out the ceiling. I'm so grateful he's younger than I am and that he's just going to be there. By the way, my health is great, so it's not like I'm going anywhere right away. Well, listen, I just want to get him on the air. Peter, are you there?
Yes, Peter, I'm here.
Come join me. And this is the fourth, folks, of in a series. I've talked to Peter now every Wednesday, and this is the fourth run, all of December, all archived, all worth listening to. I mean, you're just not going to learn more than you're going to learn from hearing Peter Gertz talk. I'm misspelling your name, Peter. It's G-O-E-T-Z-C-H-E. G-O-E-T-Z-C-H-E. Is that right?
Well, not the E in the beginning. It's
G-O-T. Oh, Jesus. I apologize. I'm a little...
No, Peter, it's only when I'm traveling that no one can write a Danish er, and then it becomes O-E.
Yeah, but, I gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just a little... I'm really very excited about our fourth session here, so I'm just babbling a bit. I really want to just unleash you to talk about the things you want to talk about, and I'll kind of just be there to catalyst it. Where do you want to begin today? What's on your mind, sir?
Well, I believe the most important thing in psychiatry is to avoid as much as possible to put people on psychiatric drugs and take people off the drugs when they are already on them, because we use these drugs so far too much so that we create so much harm with them. So we need to educate people, also the psychiatrists. Few of them know how to do it, in how you taper off psychiatric drugs safely. And I will give you just one example. Here in Denmark, it is standard practice written in a guideline that if a patient wants to come off an antidepressant drug, you halve the dose immediately. And then after 2 weeks, you can perhaps either stop or lower the dose more. And when people then develop abstinence symptoms because you halve the dose, and go to an acute clinic because they feel very badly, then I have heard repeatedly that they are sent home with the explanation there can't be anything wrong because we followed the guidelines. So we don't believe that you have such terrible side effects as you tell us. And this is really dangerous. Of course, you cannot always trust what a psychiatric patient tells you, but you should, by default, trust what they tell you because it's usually correct. So it's very dangerous just to send people home and say, I don't believe you. And ridiculous to have guidelines that say that you should halve the dose. That's far too much. The standard is more to take just 10% off and see how it goes and then a little more. So what is your comment on this, Peter?
Well, 100% agreement with you. First of all, basically, I trust what patients say more than psychiatrists. Psychiatrists, as you put it, They're in organized denial, and the patients are the ones who are going through the torture, torment, confusion, and desperation that surround taking neurotoxins, which what psychiatric drugs are. They're, by definition in reality, drugs that impair the function of neurons and neurotoxins. When I work with people taking them off drugs, I don't use the 10% method. I use the method that we work out together, usually as a family. And basically, we decide which drug to come off first, either the most dangerous one or the one that's going to be the easiest. If there's a really dangerous drug, you want to do that. But, for example, the antipsychotics. But if you've only been on the antidepressant for 2 weeks, we can just take you right off that and then get to work on the slow taper of the antipsychotic drugs. And unless I'm working with an emergency situation, my standard for withdrawal is to take off a very little bit and see how the patient feels. And if the patient comes back and says, that was easy, we can take off a little bit more. Next time, we take off a little bit more. And then if the patient calls me and says, this is not working well, I say, well, how are you feeling? Maybe you want to go back on a little, and then we slow down. So I go by being in touch by cell phone and any other means with the individual, my client or patient, to see subjectively how they're doing coming off. So it's really patient-centered. And that's the whole theme of my book on withdrawal, psychiatric drug, it's called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. It's centered around the patient's experience of withdrawal.
Of course, I agree with you, Peter. I just suggested that if people want some general guideline, I think that 50% is far too much.
Oh, I think 10% is far better than 50, absolutely.
Yes.
Yes, because if you go 10% a month, let's say, you're definitely not going to have anybody go into seizures or some other desperate physical condition. And so it's a good idea. I don't mind you raising it because it tells people to go slow, 10%. Yeah. And then you got to figure out whether it's a week or a month. But what I try to do is I try to just do it as rapidly as is comfortable for the patient, with the patient having a lot of support from whatever people are in their life and from me. And then it gets pretty complicated at times, but that's the basic idea. And it's the opposite of psychiatry, which is you go as fast as I say. it's the exact opposite. Almost everything correct is the opposite of how psychiatrists now behave. It's really dismal.
It's very strange that pills have become such an important focus in psychiatry, but perhaps it's not so. Well, it's strange if you look at how poor the effect is and how many side effects the pills have, but it's not so strange if you look at it in a psychological way that it is difficult and it takes time and patience to treat psychiatric patients. And above all, you need to invest yourself in the process. It can be painful even for yourself to provide very good psychotherapy. And the easy way is just to write a prescription. So in that way, the psychiatrist treats perhaps sometimes more the bad conscience they have because they don't use enough time to deal with the patients, learn of their stories, and give them good psychotherapy. And then it's so easy to have a pill because it becomes the primary focus for everything after that. Then you can ask, how does it go with your pills? And you can talk about that, and then there are side effects, and then you have even more to talk about. So the whole focus is switched from the human side of psychiatry, which should be the major focus, into pills that work pretty badly. Isn't that odd?
Oh, I love your emphasis, and it gives me this comical, tragic image of there's the psychiatrist behind the desk, and then there's the patient on the hard chair, and then there should be a little pedestal, and in the middle is the pill. and the psychiatrist should say, welcome, let's discuss your pill. Because that's what they do. It's the currency of the conversation. It's like discussing money. It's the currency of the whole conversation. It's all that it's about. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with the human condition of the person, their needs, their feelings, their thoughts, their conflicts at home, their aspirations at work, their physical illnesses. It's nothing to do with their real life and what they need. And you're so right that I hadn't thought of it quite that way, that in the generation of all the adverse effects, now we have more things to talk about, but we won't call them adverse effects. We'll talk about them as your latest symptoms. So you've got the antidepressant. Oh, and now you can't sleep, so you have insomnia, not an adverse drug, insomnia. So we'll give you a couple more drugs. Now you're jittery and angry and these other things. So no, we'll talk about that, but it's not called adverse effects. Now you're getting your bipolar disorder unmasked, to which the answer is unmasked. Well, I didn't have it until you gave me the drug. It's really quite bizarre. You know, and I read a lot of the records from my malpractice work, and the records are bizarre. You know, there may or may not be a note on how much medication is being taken or how it's changed. There'll be something like doing well on current dose or wants more antidepressant. I mean, maybe two or three lines like that may constitute the entire note of a fully trained and very experienced psychiatrist. It's really weird what's going on. And, you know, the more I think of these drugs as the neurotoxins, Peter, the more obvious it becomes you can't have an honest conversation about poisoning your patient. I mean, how can you have an honest conversation? How can you even look honestly at what you're doing?
Well, patients are no longer themselves. Someone described it to me the other day like this. You can have a normal state. You're yourself. You're healthy. Then you can have a psychiatric problem, which is a second state of mind. And then you get some drugs, but they don't make you normal. They create a third state of mind. So we have three different states of minds, and only one is normal. That's a pretty sharp way of seeing what the pills do to people. It's like if you give people alcohol and they get intoxicated by alcohol, it's also pretty difficult to find out which kind of person am I talking to. We wouldn't like to do that, but yet we try to learn to know people who are drugged. I mean, that can be difficult because they're no longer themselves. And another weird thing about psychiatry is the extent to which psychiatrists are fooling themselves. Then they try one drug, and it doesn't work well. They try another one. They try a third one. They increase the dose. And then sooner or later, there we found the pill that is good for you. And then both the psychiatrist and the patients think, yes, I finally found a pill that helped me. But this is very likely to be the moment where they would have become better anyhow, also without any pill. But then they make the mistake to think it is now the right pill for that patient, although the pills mostly, more or less, work in the same way. So they fool themselves. And when I was in Amsterdam recently and gave a talk, there was a panel discussion with a couple of psychiatrists on it. And I told them, why is it that it is standard all over the world that if you are depressed, you give a dose. If the patient tolerate the dose, you often double the dose after a few weeks. Why? Because if you study the effect of different doses, it seems that you don't get any more benefit by doubling the dose. But what you do get is that you more or less double the chance of getting a serious harm. So you're harming the patients this way, and yet this is standard practice all over the world to increase the dose if the patient tolerate the first dose. It is just so weird what is happening that I sometimes have difficulty grasping this. And on that particular point, the two psychiatrists who didn't, of course, always agree with me, they actually nodded and agreed with me that it doesn't help to increase the dose of an antidepressant. It just gives people more side effects.
Yeah, it is mind-boggling, Peter. You and I have both been struggling with how can this be? How can people behave this way? The doctors behave this way. You know, and you were saying that, you know, and I think it's a very important insight that the patient, in effect, begins to spontaneously get better despite the drug. And at that point, the doctor thinks we found the right drug. The other thing that happens, though, which is more grim, is the psychiatrist finally finds the right combination of many drugs, often, that make the person indifferent to their condition. I believe, and I'm working more and more on this now and looking at it more in terms of the actual neurological functioning and what the drugs do, but all of the drugs produce indifference. Once you take a neurotoxin that's going to have widespread effects in the brain, including on both the frontal lobes, the limbic system, and then on the basal ganglia and the reticular activating system, this whole energizing, humanizing portion of the brain, all the drugs eventually are impairing that overall function. And in doing so, one of the effects they get, and the pioneers of the antipsychotic drugs saw this absolutely clearly, you get a lack of interest in yourself and others. You get apathetic, you get indifferent, you don't care as much. And I think that when maybe most of the time when psychiatrists think they are getting a really good effect, and it is a drug effect, their patients are really giving up on caring. And they just say, I'm feeling better. And the psychiatrist hardly even notices they're not smiling. Because in our work, is giving drugs, we can't aim at people smiling because that's not what happens. People get more dismal over the years on our drugs. So I think a lot of what looks like improvement is indifference and apathy. Very tragic.
Yes, it's very tragic, actually. And I will give you another example of how psychiatrists may fool themselves. I debated in our Danish medical journal with a forensic psychiatrist who claimed that without drugs, it goes badly with these criminal patients, and then he said that when the patients commit new crime, it is often related to lack of effect of the drugs. And then I thought, well, come on, these drugs, antipsychotics, for example, work very poorly. So how can he know that they don't work when they work poorly anyhow? Probably because he sees that now they commit new crimes, so that must mean they don't work. But you can't have it both ways, to say that they commit crime because the drugs don't work, and I conclude they don't work because they commit crimes. This is what we call circular evidence. It is a tautology. And then I told him that, of course, you can prevent violence and new crime if you sedate the patient so much with drugs so that they become zombies. But that's not something we should really do. And actually, there are no psychiatric drugs that have a documented effect on crime, whereas we know about many drugs that they increase the risk of violence and therefore also of crime. And actually, there is a study that showed that when people fight at psychiatric departments, then in one study, half of all fights were related to the development of akathisia, this terrible side effects where people become extremely restless and which predisposes to both suicide and murder. And in another study, moderate to high doses of the old drug haloperidol made half of the patients markedly more aggressive, sometimes so much they wanted to kill their psychiatrists. So I find it very strange.
I mean, Haldol causes akathisia in some studies in most patients.
Oh, my God, yeah. But I find it very strange when we have science that tells the psychiatrist about a wholly different world than the one they have chosen to live in, and then they tell the public the opposite. I don't get it. The science is right there in front of their eyes, and yet these people, they can say that, oh, yes, these drugs, they prevent crime. They don't.
Yeah, they're a huge cause of crime. We have Thomas Moore's study about reports of violence to the FDA, and they really are, even when you take the numbers of prescriptions into account, they're very focused on a limited number of drugs, many of them causing an activation or stimulant kind of syndrome. I write a lot about this in my book, Medication Madness. The pattern I see all the time, which is follows along with what you're saying, and I really see this a lot. I probably have two or three cases at any given time in my office, stashed away, you know, that I'm working on for legal that have this pattern. A person is put on antidepressants. They start to get more and more weird it out, and then the dose is increased. And within a few days of the increase, maybe a few weeks, while the family notices they're getting agitated and anxious, the patient commits a horrendous crime out of the blue, kills a child or a family member, or robs a store in broad daylight where they're well known, or something really, really bizarre. Then they are put in jail, and their drug is continued. And in jail, this person who's never been aggressive in their whole lives stays aggressive, maybe psychotic. Then I get involved in the case, or the family gets involved, and we convince the jailer, sometimes with the intervention of a judge, to taper the person off their meds, and they go back to normal. They go to normal.
Peter,
another scenario is, for example, one on my website, the 16-year-old who on Prozac knifed his best friend to death impulsively. When he went into the jail, they took him off his Prozac. I don't think they were thinking about why, but they took him off. Maybe they didn't have it. And within weeks, the minister who worked with him in the jail, very experienced person working with people in the jail, said, this boy doesn't even belong in jail. I don't understand, let alone how he could have killed anybody. I don't understand why he's even in jail. He's not like anybody, any of the 16-year-olds in jail. So once he was off the drugs, he immediately again returned to normal. And quite frequently, given those situations, psychiatrists will want to put people back on the drugs. It's as if they're so in denial, a word that you use powerfully in your books, they're so in denial that they must ramp up their abuse. It's kind of like if a man gets the idea that somebody's critical of his abusing his wife, he tends to say, well, you think that's abuse? And he gives out more. He doubles the abuse. It kind of has that pattern. And I think underlying a lot of what goes on in psychiatry is, oh, God, Peter, and it's sad to say, it's an outlet for abuse for men in suits. I hate to say it.
Well, it surely is, and I sometimes draw parallels to the times when we had slavery. We even had slavery in the Virgin Islands, who belonged to Denmark before we sold them to the United States 99 years ago. And, of course, you abused the black people tremendously, and if they then tried to escape, and were caught, then they were abused even more. And sometimes they were simply hanged because they tried to escape. So when you have little or no rights, it's a fertile ground for tremendous abuse. I thought when you told about your law experiences that I thought, how can Peter Bragin convince the judges to stop the drugs? Because I had tried a few times as an expert witness and I couldn't convince the judges. And then it occurred to me, of course, you are a psychiatrist. The reason I wasn't believed by the judges was that I'm not a psychiatrist. So even though the psychiatrist on the other side told some horrendous things that were blatantly wrong, and I explained they were wrong, with scientific documentation, it left absolutely no impression on the judges. So what we need is, we actually need psychiatrists like you, Peter, but there are almost none of them who are prepared to stand up in court and go against all the other psychiatrists and convince the judge that this is incredibly wrong. We should stop the drugs.
Yes, I do think that that having that the psychiatrist degree makes a huge difference. But, you know, if I go back 20 years, 25 years ago, I couldn't convince them either. So I think it's partly there's a growing body of evidence in the scientific literature, and there's a growing number of successful cases that I've been involved in. So the judges know, we get a sense that this is something that's familiar. I think also that the public, which would include the judges, are getting much more aware in the U.S. of just how bad the drugging is. People are getting aware of that in the U.S. because it's much worse here, I think, than anywhere else. Although I'd be interested in your feedback on that. But I think people are just seeing it. By the way, Thomas More has out a new article this December. and looking at the rates of prescription drug use in the U.S. in any given year, he's looking at 2013. And it looks like about 50, if you count infants, about 15% of Americans in 2013 took psych drugs. 20% of women took psych drugs. 20% of white people took psych drugs, much more than all other racial groups. So we now have good data that just looking at prescription drugs, 15 to 20% of our population is on them. And we have data now on very large numbers in the hundreds of thousands of infants being put on drugs, psych drugs. So how bad, and these numbers don't reflect people who have, you know, got a bottle in their house from 2 years ago and who start on it, or whose doctor gives them a sample, or whose friends are giving them some psych drugs, or that just whatever can be captured right there in the official prescribing processes. So in America, people are really getting the idea this is being overdone more and more. But again, yeah. The psychiatry, to be able to say I'm a psychiatrist, you're absolutely right. It's got that overwhelming authority, so that a judge gets to pick between two authorities and can actually maybe try to listen to his own judgment or her own judgment. I've even had on occasion judges empower me to withdraw, to work with local authorities to withdraw a child from psychiatric drugs. So where they've taken away the child from the control of the state, and I've been allowed to work with the parents and a local pediatrician or family doc to help them withdraw the children off the drugs. And I've done that very successfully in just a very few cases.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's a mixed picture here, Peter. It's a very mixed picture in the courts. A lot of losses, a lot of failures.
Yes, yes. But we we haven't hardly gotten started in Europe, but there are some court cases, and more will be coming. So we are behind you when it comes to court cases, but we are ahead of you when it comes to overdosing the whole population. I know numbers from Europe, and you're absolutely right. The United States is the worst place in the world when it comes to psychiatric drugs. I know of no country in the whole world that drugged the population so much as in the U.S. And one important factor is that only in the U.S. and New Zealand are you allowed to advertise prescription drugs to the public. And whenever I come to America and see these TV ads with happy people who take happy pills and so on, I get nauseated. It's horrible. So that's part of the picture, that it's allowed to advertise to the public for these drugs.
That's part of the picture. Yeah, absolutely part. And another part is that we don't control the price of drugs here. And you know, I'm kind of a free market person, but these are the realities. The government, and well, actually, it fits with free market. The government enables the drug companies to charge whatever they want, say for VA patients or in Medicare. And that's a part of the trade-off with all of the current administrations. It's how Obamacare got passed, was we won't control your prices. And so we are the greatest market in the world for the drugs. And that's another reason. And huge amounts of energy goes into that marketing here. There are drugs that you can spend $50 on here and get for 50 cents in a third world country. So that's a part of it. We're just the most remunerative market. It is amazing how much the drug empire, the pharmaceutical empire, has just been able to gather the forces of psychiatry and medicine and education and government to accomplish this huge inundation of the world with drugs. It's just amazing.
I hope that sometimes in future history, people will look back at the dark ages where you and I live right now and all the listeners, and look at them with horror, thinking back at the extent to which people were drugged with pretty harmful psychiatric drugs. It's an absolute disaster, and this is why we need to inform the public about how bad it is. And as we have talked about earlier in one of your other programs, we need these detox clinics all over, many of them, and it should be free to be treated there and get rid of your drugs. That will also save money for our societies in the long run to provide these services for free, because many drugs are expensive. And when we make people incapacitated so they can't work, it also becomes very expensive for us. So you should have these services for free, and they should be all over the place. It's far worse than people who take narcotics in the street, because there are not so many of them as those who take drugs on prescription that are sometimes equally bad. And then we need to educate doctors so that they become proud of their expertise, and that they know how to take people safely off drugs that are addictive. You can confirm that, Peter. I've heard from many psychiatrists that it's far easier to stop heroin in a heroin addict than to stop a benzodiazepine, for example. Much, much easier and much quicker.
I think there's a lot of general agreement about that. Now, it's all, not just the benzos. I think it can be harder to come off the SSRI antidepressants even than the classically addictive benzos and stimulants. And in regard to the antipsychotics, once a person's been on them for years, it can be the worst horror show imaginable coming off, where you get very psychotic, you have hallucinations and delusions like you never had before. all these drugs now are really horrible to come off. And I understand that, excuse me, my phone, I hadn't shut it off. The need to find facilities, to create places where people can withdraw from drugs is just urgent. And I understand you've been thinking about that and working on that in Europe.
Yes, we will have our first one-day course this spring where we will invite both patients, relatives, and doctors and others and learn from each other how to practice safe drug withdrawal. And we created this International Institute for Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal in Göteborg in October, people from seven countries. And then we have now medicine-free clinics. And I need to find out how it works, because if you ask to be admitted to a medicine-free clinic where you are not forced to take drugs, then I wonder if it's still possible for psychiatrists at that clinic to say that, oh, now the patient is in a terrible shape, so we must transfer that patient to our usual clinic and then drug the patient against his or her will. I don't know exactly how it will work, but it has started in Norway, and we want to have these clinics in Denmark. And the first one will likely come before too long, because now we even have some funding for it. And then I want to be part of that process. And I'm also in contact with some of the politicians who have insured this money for getting started in Denmark. So it's all very exciting. We are on the right track, and we must stay there and not experience that it all gets closed down again, as you said earlier, Peter, with the Soteria experiment in California, for example, that worked so well. But the American Psychiatric Association treated Lauren Mosher, who created this, very, very badly.
Yeah, National Institutes of Mental Health treated him badly and shut it down. And that is the history, you know. In the 60s, under R.D. Lang's influence, there were also drug-free wards in the United States and Great Britain, and they were called milieu therapy wards, and they get shut down. And it addresses the question about how can psychiatrists behave so stupidly, so ignorantly, and in such denial. And the reason is that they have nothing else that they know to do. As medical doctors, my colleagues are not trained in therapy, nor can they make a great living doing therapy. They make a great living, and they're trained in drugging and shocking people, being medical doctors. So anything that's different than that is very threatening to them. And since they have all the institutionalized power, they just shut down the alternatives and the competition, just like they shut down their patients when they protest. It's important for folks to understand that this is what is going on. It's just not by chance things are as bad as they are. It's through the power of the pharmaceutical industry and the power of psychiatry, which then influences all the other prescribers. The reason I emphasize psychiatrists is not because they give the most drugs, because they don't. The most drugs are given out by pediatricians and GPs and family docs and so on. It's because it's the coalition between psychiatry and the, as you were talking earlier, Peter, the authority of the psychiatrist that that this power is exerted. And Peter, if I would love to participate in any way I can in the Denmark or Sweden or Norway, and you know, I can do interactive video from Cornell. I can much less expensively do at no cost do Skype. I won't charge a dime if I can get to participate in you know, and reinforcing what you're doing, using the fact that I'm a psychiatrist to to reinforce what you know and what you're doing. So I'd love to do that if that opportunity arises.
This is gorgeous. This is a gorgeous offer, Peter. And the leading speaker in Parliament had actually promised me to hold a hearing about abolishing forced treatment in Denmark. But she obviously became too busy, so now I will write to the speakers on health and psychiatry in Parliament and tell them that if they won't have a hearing in Parliament, I will do one on my own somewhere in Copenhagen and then invite people to come and listen and have all the arguments on the table why it is harmful to have forced treatment in psychiatry. So, this is closely linked to Medicine Free department to get rid of forced treatment. We must get there one day.
Yes, you know, and we've had much more success with stopping forced drugging than forced treatment in general. So you can have an involuntary patient in some states in the U.S., where they can be held involuntarily, but they can't be drugged involuntarily. And so one of the things you might focus on, which gives you a chance to talk about the toxicity of the drugs, is that people should not be forced to take, and it's just a starting point, to take neurotoxic agents for whom there's no evidence, good evidence for helpfulness, and tons of evidence for the harm. That's sometimes a little easier for politicians to understand than let's stop all involuntary treatment. But whichever way you go, you know, you've got my blessings.
That's also what I learned by talking to politicians in Parliament, that to start with the forced drugging would be a focused way of getting started that many people would be positive towards.
Yeah, I mean, once we start talking about the main drugs that are used for forced drugging, which are the antipsychotics, you know, we're talking about a drug that mimics the effects of a deadly disease called lethargic encephalitis that struck this planet during and shortly after World War One. Kind of overlapping with the great flu, but this was an encephalitis epidemic. We cause chemical lethargic encephalitis with those drugs. And you do it enough and you can't be violent temporarily, but then as you come out of it, not only are you very angry, you have akathisia and God knows what else from the drugs, and they encourage violence. They don't discourage it. But so I think it gives us an opportunity to focus on the most grossly toxic of the drugs, where we have a lot of history about their toxicity, and not forcing anybody ever to take them. They are literally worse than cancer drugs. I had an interesting case where a patient was given neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which is this terrible, it actually mimics acute lethargic encephalitis. You get a fever. You get delirious or otherwise compromised in your brain. You get abnormal movements, temperature. You get an encephalitis. And they mistook what they were doing for him having some rare disease. And they ended up experimentally giving this man cancer treatments. So I went to study the mental effects of the cancer treatments. But you know what? They're much less toxic to the brain. The cancer treatments that kill cells are generally less toxic to the brain than the antipsychotic drugs. I was really struck by that. I don't know if you've ever looked into that. Now, of course, the cancer drugs do impair mental function, but not the way the antipsychotic drugs do, which literally cause a chemical encephalitis throughout the whole brain, and particularly assault key movement parts of the brain. I'm going to take a breath and let you go.
Yeah.
You're going to take a breath, too.
It feels, this summer I my wife and I tried to bicycle up one of the worst mountains in Tour de France, and she actually made it to the top, which I couldn't do. My legs became too sour in the attempt. I feel that we are standing at the bottom of a mountain like that, and it's just so overwhelming to think about all the power we are up against. The richest industry in the world, the drug industry, the psychiatrists, the politicians, the patients, the relatives, many of whom have come to believe the fairy stories about the wonders of psychiatric drugs. So when you have more or less, of course, many people are critical, but yet you have too many people on the other side who believe in this fantasy land that has been created. And when you have come to believe in this, it's very, very difficult for people to see that, hey, actually things could perhaps be very, very different. Perhaps I'm wrong. It is so difficult to change the system that has become ingrained throughout the whole last century, in fact, with benzodiazepines and barbiturates and what else, bromides we had before that. So I need help, and I know you don't have the solution, Peter. You have been fighting for a lifetime, and you have obtained some remarkable results. So I guess that I just have to conclude that all of us need to go on and fight as much as we can, try to influence people. And fortunately, all these documentaries and movie films will be coming out in the coming years. I know several of the filmmakers because they have involved me in their films. So this can change people's feelings about this, just like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest also woke people up. But really not much happened. So we need more awakenings than just one or two or three. We need constant reminders of how horrible a system we have created. What's your thoughts on this, Peter?
Oh, I'm sitting here smiling and just having all kinds of conflicted thoughts. I'm smiling because I remember when I first took on whole roomfuls of neurosurgeons all by myself. Nobody in the whole profession beside me is standing up with me. And it was actually unfair because they had nothing. They had nothing and I had truth. A whole room of neurosurgeons couldn't even debate me about neurosurgery, lobotomy, psychosurgery.
Yeah, yeah.
We have truth. And that is the history of the world, that for whatever reason, there are some people who speak truth to power. Many don't survive, and we don't hear about them, or they're described in ancient texts. But you and I are doing that. I feel comfortable at age 80, having done it now for decades, to say that you and I are doing that. We are speaking truth to power. Now, from my viewpoint, as you were lamenting this huge power structure that looms over us, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, but now there are two of us. Two of us. They're really in trouble.
Yeah,
and of
well,
course, there are more. There are wonderful psychiatrists out there like Joanna Moncrief. There's a number of them in Great Britain. There are two or three young women psychiatrists here in the country who've been in communication with me. But the big change has to come from the culture. It has to be more like, you know, what eventually happened in Russia, which is, you know, people just stopped paying attention anymore to the authorities and the walls came down and nobody fired at them, or hardly anybody. But I don't know the answer, because it could be like slavery, where it took in the U.S. a bloodbath. I don't think it'll come to that, but I don't know the answer, Peter. What I do know is this, after all these years, that it is a good thing to be a person who speaks truth to power regardless of the outcome in our own times. I think we need to be thinking that we're a part of a history and that we're doing what's right. And I myself, I don't think you're thinking this way, but I myself leave it in the hands of God. God, look at the size of the of Goliath. It's in your hands whether the stone takes him out. But we got 2 minutes left.
It's very clear that you have obtained remarkable results, and you are just one man. And it's also very clear that people, persons, individuals, can actually change history. So we just need to go on fighting. And as you said, there are actually more and more people coming up also within psychiatry. So after all, I am still optimistic. We can achieve
huge numbers in the public. I really want to tell you, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I sometimes needed a bodyguard when I spoke in public. When I'd go on radio, it would be just violent callers and stuff. That the whole tone has changed now because the general public really sees that what I'm saying is needed. And everywhere I go, and you're going to find that everywhere you go, the folks, as we call them here, the folks are going to be on our side.
Yes.
And that's really important.
Yes.
Peter, thank you. Peter Goetze, the author of Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial, a marvelous Danish physician. Get that book. Get, and you rarely hear me say this about somebody else's books, get Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. And listen to all four of these on wonderful PRN website. Also go to my website where you can now look up all my shows by the names of the guests. Thank you. Happy New Year, folks. Happy New Year around the world. Happy New Year to you, Peter.